We're actually hearing my Maitreya describe his pastime to Vidura. And this is, in one sense, an in-between pastime, because it is leading to the birth and activities of Kapiladev. And the teachings of Kapiladev are very important. Prabhupada used to lecture about them. And on, in many senses, a higher level. Those teachings are on a higher level than many of the teachings that we're hearing right now. Because we're hearing how Kadama Muni, this is how the universe becomes populated, how Kadama Muni, he's praying for so long. For what purpose? Even though he knows, he himself knows his purposes are foolish, but he's praying to get a wife. He's praying for so many years, performing austerities for 10,000 years, to get a suitable wife. So on one hand, it is considered foolish. When one compares to the actual ultimate purpose of prayers, tasyaiva hetu prayate te kovito, labhyate brahmaratam upariyadha, that one really shouldn't aspire for anything, especially from God, that can be attained without God. That is on one level. Because when Krishna can award us the highest, most wonderful thing, why ask him for a lesser thing? Prabhupada would sometimes tell the story of, and you see this in Vrindavan, sometimes the village girls, you see them walking with huge, huge bundles of sticks on their head. And then if the bundle falls off, for some reason they have to put it down, they can't go like this and put it on their own heads, because it's just too big and too bulky. So one young girl was in the forest carrying the wood, and the bundle of sticks came off her head. And there was no one to help put it back on her head. So she began to pray so sincerely to the Lord. Her prayers were so sincere that Krishna actually appeared and said, "You have called me, what do you want?" And her reply was, "Please help me put the sticks back on my head." So we laugh. Why? Because Krishna is capable of awarding freedom from the material world, unlimited wealth, anything. And we ask for sticks. So this is considered foolish on one level, yet Kardama Muni did it to teach us that sometimes, even though it is foolish to not do the best thing, sometimes that is actually our position. We don't have the capacity to do the best thing. We have material desires. So then what to do? Do we not take to Krishna consciousness because of our material desires? No. Akama sarva kama va moksha kama udaradi tevena bhakti yogeni ajita purushapara. That we should, whatever our position is, whether we have material desires, have no desires, desire liberation, we should worship Krishna with great potency and strength and determination. So Kadama Muni was like that. And then the Lord came to him and was pleased with him and said, "Yes, I have already arranged what you are looking for, a wife. I have already arranged this even before you asked for it." So that is a great lesson for us as well. Because Krishna knows our needs. Sarvasya taham hridayasamivishto. He's inside our hearts. So he knows everything about us better than we know about us. So in any case, he said 2 days, the Lord said in reply to Kardama Muni's prayers, 2 days from now, Swayam Bhuvamana will come and offer you his very qualified daughter, and you should accept her. So exactly 2 days later, Swayam Bhuvamana did come with his wife Satarupa, with their daughter Devahuti. And before he didn't walk over and immediately say that, "Please take my wife." First, there was this very sweet etiquette involved. And on this section of the Bhagavatam, we learn something about culture, the Vedic culture. And this Vedic culture is more or less vanishing in the world. So what we heard last week was about the relationships between and the duties of Brahmins and the duties of Kshatriya and the essential natures of both of them, the essential, how they are both required within a society. And it wasn't that Swayambhuva Manu, the Kshatriya, glorified how important Kshatriya was. Rather, the Brahmana, Kardama Muni, glorified the importance of Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriya, Swayambhuva Manu, glorified the importance of Brahmanas. So after the Kshatriya glorified the importance of Brahmanas, and we're in chapter 22, text 8, then after this preliminary talking was completed, then the great Kshatriya, the empowered person, Swayambhuva Manu, began to speak and to reveal his mind. And he be pleased to listen to my prayer, the prayer of my humble self, for my mind is troubled by affection for my daughter. So it's the father's duty to get his daughter married. And Prabhupada explains in the purport how sometimes, although it is not proper to ask anything from the exalted spiritual master, as Swayambhuva Manu was in a disciple relationship, because he was a Kshatriya to the great sage Kardama Muni, who was the Brahmins of the spiritual masters of the Kshatriyas. So it wasn't, in one sense, it wasn't proper to ask for a favor. But yet, because he was satisfying Kardama Muni, he did ask for the favor, and that was considered legitimate. He said, my daughter is the sister of Priyavrata and Uttanapad. She is my daughter, so I am the father. Two very, very qualified brothers has she, so her family credentials are very good. She is seeking a suitable husband in terms of age, character, and good qualities. In previous times, in this Vedic culture, where marriages were built to last, a different, completely different system was followed than what is followed today. The fathers, before they would allow their daughter to marry someone, they would check about the person's brothers and sisters, and see how their grandparents were. They would check generations and generations back, because especially the father of the daughter didn't want to marry his, or the father of the son didn't want to marry his daughter to a less than an ideal family where the children might not turn out very good. This was the Vedic culture, everything done in a very, very careful fashion. So he was in anxiety. And now he's explaining, Swayambhuva Manu is explaining about the family lineage, that she is from a good family, and she is seeking a suitable husband in terms of age, character, and good qualities. The moment she heard from the sage Narad about your noble character, about your learning, about your beautiful appearance, your youth, and other virtues, she fixed her mind upon you. Therefore, Swayambhuva Manu said to Kardama Muni, please accept her, O chief of the Brahmins. For I offer her with faith, and she is in every respect fit to be your wife and to take charge of your household duties. To deny an offering that has come of itself is not commendable, even for one absolutely free from all attachment, much less one addicted to sense pleasures. So in Prabhupada's purports in this section, and from now until the end of the chapter, we're going to hear more about culture. Because in one sense, in a very real sense, there are many, you can say that the center of culture is the Vanashrama system. You can say that the center of culture is the relationship between the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. And we heard about that. And certainly that is the center of culture. Because through the Brahmanas, organizing the culture, keeping the culture on its spiritual tack. Then the Kshatriyas can rule accordingly, and society has fulfills its purpose of elevating people spiritually. So we can say that the relationship between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas is the essence of culture. But also we can say that marriage is the essence of culture, because the virtue of a cultured and pure marriage, fortuitous marriage, is that there are good children, and the child is the father of man. The child will later become the parents. And if good children are born, society is filled properly with a good population. And if bad children are born, vanasankar, unwanted children, then gradually society becomes reduced to more or less animalistic. Less than animals. I heard Prabhupada today say on a tape that when there is a dog, or even a tiger, he said, when the mother tiger gives birth to the cubs, she takes them away quickly to a different place so that no one can harm them, and even the father tiger, because she has such maternal feelings. Even rats and cats and dogs, the mothers protect their young. And they're animals. And nowadays, Prabhupada said, the mothers kill their children in the womb, so they are less than animals. So it was a very heavy indictment on contemporary civilization. And Prabhupada even refused to use the word civilization when describing what is going on. But in the Vedic times, and even not only in the Vedic times, but even while Prabhupada's own lifespan, he saw the actual culture and how it worked. So we're going to read about this. Very, very important, the relationship between the husband and wife. Now these things are not followed. And if you say that the wife is supposed to be submissive to the husband and follow the mood of the husband, the wives or the women become very affronted. But yet, what is the result? So much divorce, so much disharmony, fighting, so many children growing up without families, mother and father, the same mother and father. So let us hear carefully about what the Vedic culture is in relationship to marriage. And then the third thing, we heard about the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Then we heard about now we're hearing about marriage. And then at the end of the chapter, we hear about how to actually enjoy life. Because this whole section is written on that level. If we have material desires, how to live in such a way that we truly are peaceful and happy. Because now, people have material desires, and not only do they live in such a way that they become increasingly more miserable as they become increasingly more full of material desires, and their lives fall apart as they go increasingly in debt. So we're hearing about the elements that make up a proper material life, so that one not only enjoys his life and satisfies his material desires, which most people are mostly interested in, but also they make spiritual advancement. So the first point was the Brahman Kshatriya point, now husband-wife point, and then finally, how to really enjoy as Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed in his kingdom. First, husband-wife. The word griha medishu kameshu means in household duties. Another word is also used here, savat manu nurupam. The purport is that a wife should not only be equal to her husband in age, character, and qualities, but must be helpful to him in his household duties. The household duty of a man is not to satisfy his sense gratification. So actually both will be given. The duty, I would say in one sense, there's more emphasis that Prabhupada has given to the duties of a woman. Because the duties of a man, even though it's mentioned to some degree, they are mentioned throughout, more throughout the Bhagavatam, because the duty of the man is to become spiritually advanced. So usually what happens in a marriage, in a Kali Yuga marriage, the man is telling the wife, you should be like this, you should be like that, you should be like that. And the wife is telling the husband, you should be like that, you should be like that, you should be like that. So in this way, everyone has their mind on what everyone else should be doing. But no one has their mind on what they should be doing and their own faults and how they can perform their duties properly. And therefore, fighting. So the household duty of a man is not to satisfy his sense gratification, but to remain with a wife and children, and at the same time attain advancement in spiritual life. One who does not do so is not a householder, but a grihamedi. Two words are used in Sanskrit literature. One is grihastha, and the other is grihamedi. The difference between grihamedi and grihastha is that grihastha is also an ashram, or spiritual order. But if one simply satisfies his senses as a householder, then he is grihamedi. For a grihamedi, to accept a wife means to satisfy the senses. But for a grihastha, a qualified wife is an assistant in every respect for advancement in spiritual activities. It is the duty of the wife to take charge of household affairs and not to compete with the husband. A wife is meant to help, but she cannot help her husband unless he is completely equal to her, unless he is completely equal to her in age, character, and quality. Next purport, because we read the verse. In material life, everyone is desirous of sense gratification. Therefore, a person who gets an object of sense gratification without endeavor should not refuse to accept it. Kardama Muni was not meant for sense gratification, yet he aspired to marry and prayed to the Lord for a suitable wife. This was known to Swayambhuva Manu. He indirectly convinced Kardama Muni, you desire a suitable wife like my daughter, and she is now present before you. You should not reject the fulfillment of your prayer. You should accept my daughter. One who rejects an offering that comes of its own accord, but later begs a boon from a miser, thus loses his widespread reputation, and his pride is humbled by the neglectful behavior of others. So he's saying, you take my wife, you take my wife. Purport by Prabhupada. The general procedure of Vedic marriage is that a father offers his daughter to a suitable boy. That is a very respectable marriage. A boy should not go to the girl's father and ask her for the hand of his daughter in marriage. That is considered to be humbling one's respectable position. Swayambhuva Manu wanted to convince Kardama Muni, since he knew that the sage wanted to marry a suitable girl. Swayambhuva Manu's mood was, I am offering just such a suitable wife. Do not reject the offer. Or else, because you are in need of a wife, you'll have to ask for such a wife from someone else who may not behave with you so well. In that case, your position will be humbled. Another feature of this incident is that Swayambhuva Manu was the emperor, but he went to offer his qualified daughter to a poor brahmana. Kardama Muni had no worldly possessions. He was a hermit living in the forest. But he was advanced in culture. Therefore, in offering one's daughter to a person, the culture and quality are counted as prominent, not wealth or any other material consideration. Swayambhuva Manu. So these are the elements of marriage, again, very important, essential, because without the husband and wife relationship being right, proper, then the whole society becomes ruined. Arjuna said this. This is one of his reasons why he wished not to fight in the battle of Kurukshetra. He said, then there'll be if marriages are ruined, then there'll be Vanasankara, then all children won't be good, and then the whole society will go to hell. Swayambhuva Manu continued, oh wise man, I heard that you were prepared to marry. Please accept her hand, which is being offered to you by me, since you have not taken a vow of perpetual celibacy. So now in verses 15 through 20, Swayambhuva Manu, after he's asked, now Kardama Muni will reply. The great sage replied, certainly I have a desire to marry. And your daughter has not yet married or given her word to anyone. Therefore, our marriage according to the Vedic system can take place. Purport. There were many considerations by Kardama Muni before accepting the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. Most important is that Devahuti had first of all fixed her mind on marrying him. She did not choose to have any other man as her husband. That is a great consideration, because female psychology dictates that when a woman offers her heart to a man for the first time, it is very difficult for her to take it back. I met this one devotee, Mataji, who's, I've known her for many years, and a few years ago I saw her, and she was married to a devotee for quite a few years. And then, she was a pious, very pious lady. And then he left her. And that was 3 years ago, 3 years before I saw her. And she told me that she cried every day for 3 years. So a woman's heart is very soft. Men's heart tend to be a little hard. But a woman's heart is very soft. And she has to be taken care of very carefully in this way. Nowadays, the women, they want to become more like men, so their hearts become more hard. But this is actually the nature that's proper. They give their heart to one man, and that's it for their whole life. So, Kardama Muni continued. Let your daughter's desire for marriage, which is recognized in the Vedic scriptures, be fulfilled. Who would not accept her hand? She is so beautiful that by her bodily luster alone she excels the beauty of her ornaments. Purport. Kardama Muni wanted to marry Devahuti in the recognized manner of marriage prescribed in the scriptures. As stated in the Vedic scriptures, the first class process is to call the bridegroom to the home of the bride and hand her to him in charity with a dowry of necessary ornaments, gold, furniture, and other household paraphernalia. This form of marriage is prevalent among higher class Hindus even today and is declared in the Shastras to confer great religious merit on the bride's father. To give a daughter in charity to a suitable son-in-law is considered to be one of the pious activities of a householder. So in today's society, we talk about that the women should be given in charity to the men, and you'll have newspaper articles about you. The women will attack you. They'll picket your house. And it gets worse too. The report's very, very heavy and strong about what culture is, and this works. While today's system, even though people may be very convinced about it, it doesn't work. So Kardama Muni continues to describe the beauty of Devahuti. I've heard that Vishvavasu, the great Gandhava, his mind stupefied with infatuation, fell from his airplane after seeing your daughter playing with a ball on the roof of the palace. For she was indeed beautiful, with her tinkling ankle bells and her eyes moving to and fro. What wise man would not welcome her, the very ornament of womanhood, the beloved daughter of Swayambhuva Manu and sister of Uttanapad? Those who have not worshipped the gracious feet of the goddess of fortune cannot even perceive her, yet she has come of her own accord to seek my hand. So he's being very, very respectful. It is not that just like the Brahmins, they are in a higher position in society than Kshatriyas. But we heard how sweetly they dealt with each other. Not that the one in the higher position means that you can do anything you want and exploit and lord it over and treat the one in the lesser position like dirt or like your possession. No, not like that at all. This is culture. So on one hand, she's given to him in charity, but the other hand, he's so respectful and sweet and speaks so sweetly to her and about her. Therefore, he continues, I shall accept this chaste girl as my wife. But there's a condition. On the condition that after she bears semen for my body, I shall accept the life of devotional service, accepted by the most perfect human beings. That process was described by Lord Vishnu. It is free from envy. Here's Prabhupada's purport. Because, remember, we're speaking about what to do. The overall theme is what to do if we have material desires. So in a cultured society, one satisfies his material desires in a religious way, but yet one doesn't stay in that mood of satisfying one's desires to the last moment of one's life and die in that fashion. No. So Kadama Muni is setting the example that I'm going to do this, but at the end of my life, Hare Krishna. At the end of my life, at the appropriate time, I will leave and use the remaining part of my life for spiritual realization. So that's the condition. All clear in the beginning. Purport. We're reading from the next page. Kadama Muni desired to beget a child who would be a ray of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should beget a child who can perform the duties of Vishnu. Otherwise, there is no need to produce children. There are two kinds of children born of good fathers. One is educated in Krishna consciousness so that he can be delivered from the clutches of Maya in that very life. And the other is a ray of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and teaches the world the ultimate goal of life. As will be described in later chapters, Kadama Muni begot such a child, Kapila, the incarnation of the Personality of Godhead, who enunciated the philosophy of Sankhya. Great householders prayed to God to send his representative so that there may be an auspicious movement in human society. This is one reason to beget a child. Another reason is that a highly enlightened parent can train a child in Krishna consciousness so that the child will not have to come back again to this miserable world. Parents should see to it that the child born of them does not have to enter the womb of a mother again. Unless one can train a child for liberation in that life, there is no need to marry or produce children. If human society produces children like cats and dogs, for the disturbance of social order, then the world becomes hellish, as it has in this age of Kali. In this age, neither parents nor their children are trained. Both are animalistic and simply eat, sleep, mate, defend, and gratify their senses. This disorder in social life cannot bring peace to human society. Kadama Muni explained beforehand that he would not associate with the girl Devahuti for the whole duration of his life. He would simply associate with her until she had a child. In other words, sex life should be utilized only to produce a nice child, not for any other purpose. Human life is especially meant for complete devotion to the service of the Lord. That is the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya. So after explaining that he wouldn't spend his whole life in family life, that he would leave at some point, Kadama Muni said, why is he going to do this? Under whose authority? His answer is, the highest authority for me is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whom this wonderful creation emanates and in whom its sustenance and dissolution rest. He's the origin of the Prajapatis, the personalities meant to produce living entities in this world. So he had been asked to produce family members by Brahma, population by Brahma, and he was doing it, but he was actually listening to Krishna's authority. He knew that authority, this is Shakshadhari Tvanashramasa Sastra. He recognized that the authority of the Lord, of Vishnu, was coming through his father, Brahma, who was one of the Prajapatis. So therefore his following of Brahma was actually his trusting the authority of Lord Vishnu. So after describing this, what Swami Bhuvamanu's request was, and hearing, we've heard Kardama Muni's reply, he said conditional yes, which was acceptable. So Maitreya Muni continued, and he said, O great warrior Vidura, the sage Kardama said this much only, and then became silent, thinking of his worshipful Lord Vishnu, who has a lotus on his navel. As he silently smiled, his face captured the mind of Devahuti, who began to meditate upon the great sage. After having unmistakably known the decision of the queen, as well as that of Devahuti, the emperor most gladly gave his daughter to the sage, whose host of virtues was equaled by the sage whose host of virtues was equaled by hers. Empress Satyarupa lovingly gave most valuable presents suitable for the occasion, such as jewelry, clothes, and household articles, in dowry to the bride and the bridegroom. So the, in India especially, now they don't have, nowhere in Australia or any Western country they have dowries, right? No. In India, very difficult to get your daughter married unless you have at least 300,000 rupees or so as a dowry. 3 lakhs or so, or something to give. But this is what Prabhupada says about the dowry. In this way, Kardama Muni was married with first opulence, with full opulence to a qualified wife, and was endowed with the necessary paraphernalia for household life. In the Vedic way of marriage, such a dowry is still given to the bride, to the bridegroom by the father of the bride. Even in poverty-stricken India there are marriages where hundreds and thousands of rupees are spent for a dowry. The dowry system is not illegal, as some have tried to prove. The dowry is a gift given to the daughter by the father to show goodwill, and it is compulsory. In rare cases where the father is completely unable to give a dowry, it is enjoined that he must at least give a fruit and a flower. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, God can be pleased even by a fruit and a flower. When there is financial inability and no question of accumulating a dowry by other means, one can give a fruit and a flower for the satisfaction of the bridegroom. So I am continuing describing Swayam Bhuvamanu. Thus relieved of his responsibility by handing over his daughter to a suitable man, Swayam Bhuvamanu, his mind agitated by feelings of separation, embraced his affectionate daughter with both his arms. The emperor was unable to bear the separation of his daughter. So it wasn't here, oh, finally I got rid of her. No, he loved her so much. This was family life. There was so much affection between the members of the family. So much affection. And nowadays, people grow up with little affection, and therefore they don't know how to accept love or give love. So then they have to take courses and seminars and things like that and pay lots of money. But it doesn't work. This is what society, this is what culture is. The emperor was unable to bear the separation of his daughter. Therefore tears poured from his eyes again and again, drenching his daughter's head as he cried, "My dear mother, my dear daughter." Listen to this purport. The word Amba is significant. A father sometimes addresses his daughter in affection as mother and sometimes as my darling. Amba means mother. The feeling of separation occurs because until the daughter is married, she remains the daughter of the father. But after her marriage, she is no longer claimed as a daughter in the family. She must go to the husband's house. For after marriage, she becomes the property of the husband. How would that go over today? According to Manu Samhita, a woman is never independent. She must remain the property of the father when she is not married, and she must remain the property of the husband until she is elderly and has grown up children of her own. In old age, when the husband has taken sannyas and left home, she remains the property of the sons. A woman is always dependent either upon father, husband, or elderly sons. After asking and obtaining the great sage's permission to leave, the monarch Swayambhuva Manu mounted his chariot with his wife and started for his capital, followed by his retinue. Along the way, he saw the prosperity of the tranquil seers, beautiful hermitages, on both the charming banks of the Saraswati, the river so agreeable to saintly persons. So then, now we're hearing of this, the third cultural point. Of course, there's many points in here, but this is of a king, and the king is, in one sense, the symbol of how to enjoy the material world. A brahmana doesn't enjoy the material world. He doesn't want to be in the material world. He guides people out of the material world. But a kshatriya, he is the symbol of enjoyment. And he's the hero. He has character. He has bravery. He leads others. He's the leaders amongst men. He's wealthy. He is bold. He will not refuse a challenge, and he treats the citizens like his own children, with that much affection and care. So overjoyed to know of his arrival, Swayambhuva Manu's subjects came forth from Brahmavarta to greet. That's Bahishmati. Brahmavarta is the district or something like that. So the citizens came forward from Brahmavarta to greet their returning lord with songs, prayers, and musical instruments. So they were so thrilled that he was returning. Naturally, they loved their king so much. It is natural. The city of Bahishmati, rich in all kinds of wealth, was so called because Lord Vishnu's hair dropped there from his body when he manifested himself as Lord Boar. So we just heard about Lord Boar earlier in this canto. As Lord Boar shook his body, this very hair fell and turned into blades of evergreen kusha grass and kasha, another kind of grass used for mats, by means of which the sages worshipped Lord Vishnu after defeating the demons who had interfered with the performance of their sacrifice. Manu spread a seat of kusha and kasha and worshipped the Lord, the personality of Godhead, by whose grace he had obtained the rule of the terrestrial globe. Prabhupada's purport. So now the descriptions in Prabhupada's, the cultural descriptions in Prabhupada's purports turn from marriage to kingship and how to enjoy the material world, how really to enjoy the material world. Here's what Prabhupada explains. Manu is the father of mankind, and therefore from Manu comes the word man, or in Sanskrit, manusha. Those who are in a better position in the world, having sufficient wealth, should especially take lessons from Manu, who acknowledged his kingdom and opulences to be gifts from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus always engaged in devotional service. First point, this wealth that I have, whatever it is, big or small, is not mine. It is a gift from Krishna. And therefore it should be used in the service of he who gave it to me. Similarly, the descendants of Manu, or the human beings, especially those who are situated in well-to-do condition, must consider that whatever riches they have are gifts from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Those riches should be utilized for the service of the Lord in sacrifices performed to please Him. That is the way of utilizing wealth and opulence. No one can achieve wealth, opulence, good birth, a beautiful body, or a nice education without the mercy of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, those who are in possession of such valuable facilities must acknowledge their gratefulness to the Lord by worshipping Him and offering what they have received from Him. When such acknowledgement is given, either by a family, nation, or society, their abode becomes almost like Vaikuntha, and it becomes free from the operation of the threefold miseries of this material world. In the modern age, the mission of Krishna consciousness is for everyone to acknowledge the supremacy of Lord Krishna, Whatever one has in his possession should be considered a gift by the grace of the Lord. Everyone, therefore, should engage in devotional service through Krishna consciousness. If one wants to be happy and peaceful in his position, either as a householder or citizen or member of human society, one must promote devotional service for the pleasure of the Lord. So this is the key. If one gives to Krishna, the idea is that Krishna reciprocates so much and he gives true happiness to the person. So this is the basic secret. Bhoktaram jagatapasam savalokam maheshwaram suridam sava bhutani gyatvamam shantim richati. Having entered the city of Varhishmati, in which he had previously lived, Manu entered his palace, which was filled with an atmosphere that eradicated the three miseries of material existence. Now this purport is very important, because very often we talk about we become Krishna conscious and you become happy, and we become Krishna conscious and we don't suffer, and then we take to Krishna consciousness thinking, boy, I'll chant Hare Krishna and then everything will be so smooth and sweet and there won't be any difficulties. And then, as it happens, difficulties do come, they must come. And then we think, what is Krishna consciousness? They said I was going to become happy and there are difficulties. Therefore it doesn't work. But actually the happiness is on a different level. According to our karma, according to the body we're wearing, we have a certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of distress, and that cannot be changed, basically. Of course Krishna can change it, and he does. He takes special care of the devotee. But everyone has a particular amount of joy and misery to suffer in this life. So where is the benefit of Krishna consciousness if we have a certain amount of joy and misery to suffer? And then how will we be happy if we take to Krishna consciousness? Prabhupada's purport is very nice. We should listen carefully. The material world, or material existential life, is filled with threefold miseries. Miseries pertaining to the body and mind, miseries pertaining to natural disturbances, and miseries inflicted by other living entities. Human society is meant to create a spiritual atmosphere by spreading the spirit of Krishna consciousness. The miseries of material existence cannot affect the status of Krishna consciousness. So the spirit of Krishna consciousness has to be adopted. And then the miseries of the material world do not affect the status of Krishna consciousness, but yet there are miseries. So what does this mean? It is not that the miseries of the material world completely vanish when one takes to Krishna consciousness, but it is a fact that as soon as most of the miseries come because of engaging in illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. That's where most of the miseries come from. As soon as one gives up these things, immediately one is so much more situated in goodness, and most miseries immediately vanish. But it is not that the miseries of the material world completely vanish when one takes to Krishna consciousness. But for one who is Krishna conscious, the miseries of material existence have no effect. So the miseries are there, but they don't affect one if one is fully Krishna conscious. According to how much one is Krishna conscious, not bodily and mind conscious, one will become free from miseries. We cannot stop the miseries of the material atmosphere. But Krishna consciousness is the antiseptic method to protect us from being affected by the miseries of material existence. For a Krishna conscious person, both living in heaven and hell are equal. How Swayambhuva Manu created an atmosphere wherein he was not affected by material miseries is explained in the following verses. So we'll read the verses and then some of the purports. Now these are all very important, because this is how to actually live happily and peacefully in the material world. Emperor Swayambhu Vimana enjoyed life with his wife and subjects and fulfilled his desires without being disturbed by unwanted principles contrary to the process of religion. Celestial musicians and their wives sang in chorus about the pure reputation of the emperor, and early in the morning every day they used to listen to the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with a loving heart. They would hear Harikatha. The word is Anubandena Riddha, with the heart attached to Krishna. Shrinvan, listening to Harikatha, topics about Krishna. So he would hear Krishna Katha, he would not act against principles of religion. Thus Swayambhu Vimana was a saintly king. Although absorbed in material happiness, he was not dragged to the lowest grade of life, for he always enjoyed his material happiness in a Krishna conscious atmosphere. So his Krishna consciousness was, his happiness was not against Krishna consciousness, and the way he became happy, the means he became happy, were not against the principles of Krishna consciousness. So therefore he was not dragged down from the spirit of Krishna consciousness. So therefore material miseries could not touch him. Consequently, although his duration of life gradually came to an end, his long life, consisting of a Manvantara era, was not spent in vain, since he always was writing down and chanting the pastimes of the Lord. He was always engaged in Krishna consciousness. So therefore, and we've heard this two times already, once about Kardama Muni and once in the early part of the second canto, that the passing of a day and a night, it steals away the life of a materialistic person, but it does not touch, it cannot touch a devotee who's interested in, involved in hearing and chanting about Krishna. He passed his time, which lasted 71 cycles of the four ages, that means 71 times 4,320,000 years. So that time was always spent thinking of Vasudeva and always engaged in matters regarding Vasudeva. Thus he transcended the three destinations, which means goodness, passion, and ignorance, which means the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems, and also it means the awake, dreaming, and deep sleep stages. These are different threes in consciousness. So he transcended them by always thinking about Krishna. Therefore, O Vidura, how can persons completely under the shelter of Lord Krishna and devotional service be put into miseries pertaining to the body, the mind, and nature, and other men, and other living creatures? How can persons completely under the shelter of Lord Krishna and devotional service, how can they be put into any kind of miseries? So this is the key. We want the freedom from miseries, but we don't want to take full shelter of Krishna and devotional service, and therefore we don't succeed. Don't succeed in being free from miseries, and we don't succeed in taking shelter of Krishna. The whole thing. In reply to questions asked by certain sages, he, Swayambhu Vimana, out of compassion for all living entities, taught the diverse sacred duties of men in general and the different varnas and ashramas. So that's the famous Manusamhita. I've spoken to you of the wonderful character of Swayambhu Vimana, the original king, whose reputation is worthy of description. Please hear as I speak of the flourishing of his daughter Devahuti. So now we've heard about that part, and now we will move on. And eventually we will hear about the birth of Kapila Muni and his teachings. So let's hear some of the purports on how actually to enjoy life. So first we heard, first principle is to hear about Krishna and to accept whatever opulences you have. Some people may have by their karma great opulences, some people may have a small amount, but whatever we have, we should use it to glorify Krishna, knowing everything is a gift of him. And then we heard how miseries must be there, but if the atmosphere and our consciousness is fixed on Krishna, then the miseries cannot touch us. It is understood that Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed his household life by following these principles. It is stated here that early in the morning there were musicians who used to sing with musical instruments about the glories of the Lord. And the emperor, with his family, personally used to hear about the pastimes of the Supreme Person. This custom is still prevalent in India in some of the royal families and temples. Professional musicians sing with shanais, and the sleeping members of the house gradually get up from their beds in a pleasing atmosphere. During bedtime also, the singers sing songs in relationship with the pastimes of the Lord, with shanai accompaniment, and the household is gradually full of sleep, remembering the glories of the Lord. In every house, in addition to the singing program, there is an arrangement for Bhagavatam lectures in the evening. Family members sit down, hold Hare Krishna Kirtan, hear narrations from Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and enjoy music before going to bed. The atmosphere created by this Sankirtan movement lives in their hearts, and while sleeping, they also dream of the singing and glorification of the Lord. In such a way, perfection of Krishna consciousness can be obtained. This practice is very old, as learned from this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. Millions of years ago, Swayambhuva Manu used to avail himself of this opportunity to live household life in the peace and prosperity of a Krishna conscious atmosphere. As far as temples are concerned, in each and every royal palace or rich man's house, inevitably there is a nice temple. And the members of the household rise early in the morning and go to the temple to see the Mangalarti ceremony. The Mangalarti ceremony is the first worship of the morning. In the Arati ceremony, a light is offered in circles before the deity, as are a conch shell and flowers and a fan. The Lord is supposed to rise early in the morning and take some light refreshment and give audience to the devotees. The devotees then go back to the house or sing the glories of the Lord in the temple. The early morning ceremony still takes place in Indian temples and palaces. Temples are meant for the assembly of the general public. Temples within palaces are especially for the royal family. But in many of these palaces, the public is also allowed to visit. If one goes there, he will see that the temple of the king of Jaipur is situated within the palace. But the public is allowed to assemble, and if one goes there, he will see that the temple is always crowded with at least 500 devotees. So what is the deity's name in that temple? What is his name? Huh? Govindaji. He's the Lord of Jaipur. Have you been? Why? So get fortunate. See Govinda. He's wonderful. He was installed by Srila Rupa Goswami. Very wonderful. Have you ever seen a picture of Govinda?
Probably have, but no, I wouldn't know exactly. I think very much last year when the year before we were devoted came from Jaipur, Australia.
Oh, yeah.
He was selling pictures.
Yeah. Did you get one, a picture of Govinda? Where is that picture? Oh, but he called you back. Very good. After the Mangalarti ceremony, they sit down together and sing the glories of the Lord with musical instruments. It's very, really moving when you go, because all the people in the town of Jaipur, they're devotees of Govindaji. And they sing so sweetly, so sweetly. They have so much love for Govinda. Temple worship by the royal family is also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, where it is stated that those who fail to achieve success in bhakti yoga principles within one life are given a chance to take birth in the next life in a family of rich men or a royal family or a family of learned brahmanas or devotees. If one gets the opportunity to take birth in these families, he can achieve the facilities of a Krishna conscious atmosphere without difficulty. A child born in that Krishna conscious atmosphere is sure to develop Krishna consciousness. The perfection which he failed to attain in his last life is again offered in this life, and he can again make himself perfect without fail. Then we heard Swayambhuvamana was a saintly king. Although absorbed in material happiness, he was not dragged to the lowest grade of life, for he always enjoyed his material happiness in a Krishna conscious atmosphere. So, because of this Krishna conscious atmosphere, in spite of the material enjoyment, they made advancement in pure Krishna consciousness without a doubt. At the present moment, modern civilization is too much attached to the material way of life or sense gratification. Therefore, the Krishna consciousness movement can give the people in general the best opportunity to utilize their human life in the midst of material enjoyment. Krishna consciousness does not stop them in their propensity for material enjoyment, but simply regulates their habit in their life of sense enjoyment. In spite of their enjoying their material advantages, they can be liberated in this life by practicing Krishna consciousness by the simple method of chanting the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And the last bit of the purport we'll read is the text 35. And the verse was, consequently, although Swayambhuvamanu's duration of life gradually came to an end, his long life, consisting of a Manvantara era, it was not spent in vain, since he ever engaged in hearing, contemplating, writing down, and chanting the pastimes of the Lord. Prabhupada's purport. As freshly prepared food is very tasteful, but if kept for 3 or 4 hours, it becomes stale and tasteless. So the existence of material enjoyment can endure as long as life is fresh. But at the fag end of life, everything becomes tasteless and everything appears vain and painful. That's something to look forward to, isn't it? The life of Emperor Swayambhuvamana, however, was not tasteless. As he grew older, his life remained as fresh as in the beginning because of his continued Krishna consciousness. The life of a man in Krishna consciousness is always fresh. It is said that the sun rises in the morning and sets in the evening, and its business is to reduce the duration of everyone's life. But the sunrise and sunset cannot diminish the life of one who engages in Krishna consciousness. Swayambhuvamanu's life did not become stale after some time, for he engaged himself always in chanting about and meditating upon Lord Vishnu. He was the greatest yogi because he never wasted his time. It is especially mentioned here, Vishnu Korvato Bruvata Kutkata. When he talked only of Krishna and Vishnu, the personality of Godhead. And when he heard something, it was about Krishna. When he meditated, it was upon Krishna and his activities. Okay, we'll stop here. So now we'll continue tomorrow hearing about what happened to Devahuti. So Swayambhuvamanu has gone back to his palace. And now we'll hear what happens. He's left Devahuti with Kadama Muni. We'll hear what happens. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes?
Why should we encourage creation?
Creation, meaning of children or of what?
What is detached with all the other things?
See, this is on a particular level. This section is on a particular level. That the having of children, there's two ways to look at it. One is, this is a natural desire of a man and a woman. So therefore, So this is a natural desire of a man and a woman. So if one has that desire and it is out of and he must fulfill it, one should fulfill it in a Krishna conscious fashion. And therefore have Krishna conscious children. Or if one is, even if one isn't inclined, if one has a specific duty to do to have Krishna conscious children, everyone who's married will have children, basically. Either that, or nowadays maybe they don't have children because they kill the children. But every civilized person they get married and they have children. But then there's another kind of person who does not have the desire to get married. And those kind of people don't have children because they're not married. There's no need. That is the preferred thing. But you're talking about someone who gets married but is detached and doesn't want to have children, it sounds like.
No. You know, if you are trying to be detached, then there is no point in getting attached to children. So it's better not to carry.
But most people aren't on either this side or this side, so much like that. They usually take a more middle path. So we become attached to things that most people, this is our experience in the world. If someone has the facility to actually be detached, he should be detached and shouldn't get involved with attachment to children, the physical children. Yes?
Yeah, but so the encouragement should be that to be completely detached.
But the Bhagavatam, as I was trying to explain, the Bhagavatam is written on different levels. So the ultimate level is one should be detached from matter and only attached to Krishna. But everyone can't be on that level. So what should they do? So they need to be encouraged too. So the encouragement for that level of people is that you live a Krishna conscious life in family life. So that particular section is what we're hearing now. In the beginning of the section, the same mood was there, because Kodama Muni was explaining that I'm very foolish for worshipping you to get something material, but yet I am very foolish, so let me still worship you. Because he is the Lord of all benedictions. So this verse in the Bhagavatam, Akama Savakamava Moksha Kama Udaradi, is very important. It means that whether you have no material desires, which is the best position, or you're full of material desires, or you desire liberation, whatever your condition is, you should worship Krishna with great power and strength and devotion. And that will clean everything out of the heart and make you fully pure. So we don't reject people who are not yet 100% purified. Not at all. But it is better to be fully detached. But there's another half of being fully detached. One should be fully attached to Krishna. That is the more important of the two, even. Because if one is attached to Krishna fully, then detachment from matter automatically comes. Anyway, did I answer your question, or did you want to say something else?
It's very difficult to understand.
It's like everyone can't receive the same instruction. Everyone doesn't receive the same instruction. When the doctor is there, does he tell everyone the same thing? So he tells one person to fast and he tells another person to eat. Mm-hmm. So the person who is told to fast, he says, it's like asking, why is he being told to eat and why is I being told to... Because we have different diseases. So if one has a very, very serious disease, he is told one thing.
People don't understand. They say that they have children, everything is okay, but there are so many miseries.
The what?
There are so many miseries in this world. So...
Unavoidable.
Yeah. So the best thing is to encourage complete detachment.
But...
So there is no worry, no problem.
But most people, if you talk about detachment too much, they will have no interest because they realize they can't do it.
Yeah, but if you encourage limited attachment, then also people criticize that.
But therefore, the Bhagavatam has the balance, everything in its perspective, and we explain the point. We explained it, I think, very clearly, as clear as I'm able to do. There's no encouragement of attachment. See, we'll see with Kodama Muni, for example. His attachment, he said, I'm leaving. He got involved in household life, but yet it was with the condition that he would not stay in there to the end of their life. So there's different times of our life. So one who is not pure enough to remain brahmachari uninvolved in family life for his whole life, he can get married. He can get married because everyone won't be pure enough. But yet he should know that he shouldn't remain immersed in comfortable household life to the very end because he's going to die. It's in our own interest to become detached. So the Bhagavatam speaks mostly on that level, mostly on the level of detachment. But these other points are also there, and they're also important. Okay? Thank you. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. So we'll continue tomorrow speaking about Devahuti and Kardama Muni.